I have the absolute pleasure tonight of introducing our dinner speaker. I'm really excited about this because I've known Randy Weingarten for many, many years as a reporter, like many of you, covering press conferences, waiting to see what would happen with the teacher contract, calling all weekend long to see if there'd been any break in the negotiations, getting her comment immediately on something one of the many, many chancellors who have run New York City school systems have done, or why they quit, or why they were voted out. It was one after another. But this week I learned two new and really interesting facts about Randy that I never knew in all my years as a reporter. One is that she is really an amazing chess player. And I never knew that before, but I think when you consider that she has just been started this week as the head of the American Federation of Teachers, she and in all the years I've seen her try and negotiate contracts and deal with a school system of 1.1 million children and incredibly difficult politics, she kind of needs those skills. The other thing I learned is that one of the hardest things for her about taking this new job, leaving from the United Federation of Teachers to the AFT, although she's going to be doing both for a while, is the fate of a Cocker Spaniel named Chloe. Cockapoo. Does Chloe come to D.C.? Does Chloe live in New York? Or does Chloe live a divided life? So those are two of the things that she's grappling with. Just this week, she became the new president of the AFT, succeeding Edward McElroy. That is a 1.33 million member union. And if you don't know much about this union, you will soon. This is really the first time she's addressed reporters since she took on that job. This is a pretty big job. She succeeds the legendary Albert Shanker and Sandra Fellman. And in her own life, Randy is a lawyer who worked early in her career on Wall Street. And she recently said her motivation in taking this, in getting involved in unions, was after her father was laid off from his job as an electrical engineer. He came home to their house in Nyack, New York, really humiliated and upset. And she realized that she never wanted to see something like that again. Her mother was also a teacher there. Tonight we've asked her to address some of the pressing issues that I think will really be facing all of your school systems as well as the country as the administration changes. And that is some of her priorities as she heads this union. She's already said that the first thing she's going to do is declare war on the No Child Left Behind Act. And her most urgent priority is to overhaul that law and develop a new vision to close the achievement gap. Also, the AFT last week voted overwhelmingly to endorse Barack Obama. So I've asked her to talk a little bit about what the support of the union and its resources might mean in the upcoming election. And she said overall, and I'd like you to feel free to ask her questions about that, how does she see her role as a union leader? Something of an advocate for students as well as for union members. And also, I want her to expand on that. And she has been described in the New York Times as a combative deal maker and consummate political street fighter for the city teacher.
So this is Liz. You know, Liz talks about my ability to negotiate. Liz is the consummate negotiator because she sees me at something we're doing, I guess, in Chicago. Was it in Chicago in March or April? I'm forgetting the months now. And she says, "You have to be here." And I'm like, "I have to be here, New York. Wait a second, I think that's the week of the AFT convention." And she says, "Of course you're going to be in New York." And she actually is relentless over the course of the next few weeks until I finally say, okay, I'm going to do it. And various different people said, what are you going to do right after you become president of the union? Now, those of you who know me know that what I'm about to say is very funny. I said, I'm going to take a vacation. And so they said, well, so I became the president on Monday. I went to Washington, so I was still in Chicago Monday to Tuesday. I went to Washington on Wednesday. And, you know, normally after that you would actually go on vacation. But no, I was going to be here tonight. So moved all sorts of things around, so you are actually my last gig before I take my first vacation of the last 8 months. So I am actually really pleased to be here, And if I look like I have a very big, broad smile afterwards, it's because I will be very pleased to turn my brain off for a little while after tonight. I have a bunch of things that I could say, and I will say if you want me to. I'll talk for a few minutes, probably about 10, 20 minutes. And then, Elizabeth, you look like you have a headache from me already. I'm teasing you. And then I just really want you to have the opportunity to ask questions. The New York folk know me for a while, but many of you around the country don't. Some of you have AFT locals in your jurisdiction, some of you don't. Some of you have NEA locals, and some of you are in non-bargaining states. But I wanted to do this because and I know a lot of people talk about the press as the fourth estate, and normally they sneer about the press. These days they sneer about the press more than they sneer about lawyers. But ultimately, you are a really important translator. You translate and communicate, whether it's in newsprint or on the internet, really complicated concepts. And education is one of those really complicated concepts. It gets morphed into who's right and who's wrong. And I guess at the end of the day, if there's a theory about anything I'm going to say today, it's that those who try, I'm not speaking loud enough. Is that better?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now? Is it better?
Yeah.
Okay. Those who get things down to 2 or 3 second sound bites or a minute sound bites and think that they can solve the problems of the world by simply saying, oh, we need more accountability. Oh, just get rid of ineffective teachers. Just get rid of the unions. Ultimately, it makes a great sound bite, but it's doomed to fail. Because at the end of the day, in terms of education, it is very much like it was when most of you went to school, whether that was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or like me, 30 years ago. The key interaction in schooling is still the interaction between teacher and child. It's the key interaction. And if that's the key interaction in schooling, then you have to think about how do you motivate, how do you create an environment where you can get the best out of that interaction. And the best out of that interaction on an individual basis and the best out of that interaction on a school basis. And so if one thinks that the way to do that is to whip teachers into shape, ultimately, at the end of the day, what you'll get, because teachers are actually selfless individuals, and they're actually amazing people, most of them. You're always going to find somebody who you will say, that person should never have been a teacher. And you and I might agree on a lot of the people who you would have said, that person should never have been a teacher. But if you close your eyes and you think about all the people you have covered and all the people you've had in education, many of them as teachers, many of them are people that you still revere. Because many of them, I would say most of them, went into this life to make a difference in the lives of others. They certainly had the wherewithal, most of the teachers I know, to become investment bankers or lawyers or doctors or electrical engineers or other kinds of professions where they could have made a lot more money. But most of them do this because they want to make a difference in the lives of kids. So when you have someone who has that sense of purpose, the worst thing to do to them is to try to whip them into shape. Because what you do is you break their spirit. And when you break their spirit, this is what they do. They'll listen. They'll be nice. because teachers, by and large, are pretty nice people. But there'll be something like malicious compliance. You break that spirit of them wanting to be the best they can be, of them wanting to go that extra mile, of them wanting to go home and think about every single day, what am I going to do for Janie or Johnny or Julio or Camille? Most of the time, what teachers do is they're physicians of the mind. And you want to motivate them to be the best that they can be in that way. And so when you see folks who say, on both sides, if you see folks on management side that keep saying, nope, we just have to get rid of these union rules, or we just have to have an accountability system that's based upon test scores. And then you see on the union side, people say, nope, we're just going to fight. Because anything that management says, because they're saying it, like anything that Joel Klein says, because he's saying it, has to be wrong. Both those extremes don't do anything to help children. So there are a bunch of us who have started saying, for a while, and I actually got accused of being soft and being too into kumbaya and things like that at the beginning of the last school year here. There are a bunch of us who've started to say, if we really want to help all children learn or get to their God-given potential, then we actually have to work together in a real way. We actually have to take the word collaboration and make it real. Not say, good, I'm sitting with management and labor are sitting together for a minute and a half, we've now collaborated because we've told them what we're about to do. And so when you have, for example, and that's why I'll start here, a Barack Obama saying, regardless of what else he says, but saying to the AFT, as he did this week, we must help all children learn. Our obligation is to help, I'm not quoting him directly, I'm using my words for his words. We must help all kids. And he says in the next breath, and even if we may have differences of opinion about how to do that, the one abiding concept he promised us was that he would do reform with teachers, not to them. And that got him a standing ovation at the AFT convention. And that wasn't terribly dissimilar from some of the stuff I said in my speech, because what my whole focus was, we had about 3,500 people in the room, was about first priority, not declaring war on No Child Left Behind. I did say that some of our members do think it is a four-letter word, which it is, I guess, NCLB. I did say that. I said it's a four-letter word. I started with N, and everybody continued CLB. But I believe our first priority as a union is to do what we can to improve the institutions in which we work and to do what we can so that our members are the best that they can be. Because at the end of the day, if the institutions in which we work, and I can focus on education, but we represent nursing, we represent healthcare employees, we represent public service employees, we represent powers, we represent higher ed, so I try to make it broader. If we improve the institutions where we work, if we create or recreate a confidence in the common good, which was the central pillar of democracy, public institutions. If we recreate a confidence in our labor movement, which actually was what created a middle class, which actually probably was a middle class, what enabled many of you to go to college. If we recreate a sense of lifting all boats and lifting people out of poverty, not just the exceptional child here or there that gets to be the next Bill Gates,
But lifting a whole class of people out of poverty and creating or recreating a middle class and an economic base in America so that people can live even if gas prices are $5 a gallon. And if we also do what we need to do in terms of education, which is after talking about it for 50 or 60 years, actually trying to take the steps to eliminate the achievement gap once and for all, so that you have this laser-like focus on the schools that are not performing well at the same time as you ensure that the schools that are performing well continue to do so. That's what I want the AFT's role to be in America. And what I was really grateful about and gratified about is I put, you can read my whole speech on the web, it's on the AFT website, it's on the UFT website. You read that speech. That's essentially what I said in essentially those terms to my members. And they responded hugely. So it wasn't about, look, I don't like No Child Left Behind. Not that I don't like high standards. I believe in high standards hugely. For kids, I believe in it for my staff. Those of you who have covered me know I'm a very tough taskmaster in terms of my own, with my own staff. But what No Child Left Behind has become, and if you want to ask me more questions about this, I'd be pleased to answer them. It's been much more about sanctions and testing than it is about teaching and ensuring that we really reach deep into helping educate the whole child. And whereas math and English are incredibly important, everything can't be about just figuring out how to bubble in multiple choice tests. And ultimately, and we'll see this even in New York, we'll have to see what the next set of NAEP scores are. If No Child Left Behind had been that hugely successful, we'd also be seeing it after 7 years in SAT scores, in college preparation, in all sorts of other data, in the number of kids that take AP classes and pass in AP classes. If it was really, really, really that successful, not just that successful in terms of how to align test prepping with test scores, but if it was really successful in all these other ways where kids were getting not just a high school diploma, but a really deep understanding of how to operate in the world, we'd be seeing it in all these other data points. And we haven't been seeing it that way. So the real question for me is, how do you actually get to end the achievement gap? How do you actually help every single child that public education serves, and we still serve 90% of the kids in America, how do you actually help them reach their God-given potential? And this is how I got to the community school idea. Because we know that the single most important resource is still a school teacher. For a lot of the reasons that I said earlier, you've heard it with data and all sorts of other things in other ways, and I've heard that you've had a bunch of different speakers today, and you'll have a bunch of different speakers other days as well, or this weekend as well. But there is a big consensus now that the quality of the teacher is the most important factor. But take even New York for a second, where even Joel Klein and Michael Bloomberg would agree that we've done a lot to ensure teacher quality. When he's not mad at me, even the mayor will say, we have the best teaching force in the United States of America. Increased the salaries in the last 6 years, 43%. And then are doing these school-based bonuses in hard-to-staff schools on top of that. Did some other kinds of differentiated pay on top of that, including a career ladder program, some housing bonuses. Done all the things that have been on like the what the so-called agenda is of, you know, how to improve teacher quality. And parents these days will tell you, new survey out, largest survey of parents ever, 94% of them said that they like or love their kids' teachers. So you have a lot of, quote, data points that are telling you we have great teachers in New York City. Yet our graduation rate is still hovering around 50%. So what does that say in terms of what else is needed? that's how I started thinking about what do good schools do or communities do to help a whole child. And ultimately what we see is that we can't do it alone in schools. We have to do everything we can do, but we can't do it all ourselves. And a law that just presumes that all of the responsibility is on the backs of teachers and principals is a law that will ultimately be unsuccessful. And essentially, that's what No Child Left Behind is about. It basically puts all the pressure or focus on teachers and principals. So we said, or I said in this speech, we have to be for high standards. We have to be for accountability that works both to build capacity as well as have transparency. But let's also think about the other things we have to do to ensure that we not only educate the whole child, but particularly for our neediest children, give them the other resources that they need, such as kids need somewhere to go after school. If you don't want kids to be on the streets, particularly younger kids, when if they have more than a single parent home, or if they only have a single parent home, what are they going to do if their parent is at home? Or if both parents work, what are they going to do? So that's part of trying to find a way to keep the schoolhouse open so that you can have after-school programs that are recreational in part, not just about homework help. But you also have homework help and tutoring help so that the kids are falling behind, they get the help immediately instead of in the summer. The same is true with things like medical clinics, dental clinics. There's a bunch of research that now shows, at least in rural areas, poor rural areas, and poor urban areas, that if kids don't get dental care, if kids don't get eye care, if kids don't get preventative care, look at New York City, highest asthma rates. I don't know about any of you, but I'm an asthmatic. And if my asthma is kicking up, I don't want to do a blessed thing that day. All I want to do is sit and make sure I can get my breath. I'm not going to focus on schooling. Kids are obese. They're going to focus on schooling. So the notion of having some kind of preventative health care that's attached to schools doesn't have to be a clinic in the school. But if you have, like you have, we're in Upper New York right now. We're at the steps of Harlem. Columbia Presbyterian is 20, 30, 40 blocks away. Mount Sinai is a couple of blocks away. Why don't you have that kind of integration of services? And the difference between now and a few years ago when this was initially raised is that when mayors are starting to push at mayoral control, why don't they use this huge authority they have over the other public services to try to create an integration of services? Why not do some of that stuff too so that you can have an integration of services and so a parent can go to a school and see that all the services are located in the school? And you can actually even have a bolder vision than that where you say, well, why don't we also look at what we can do for parents? I don't know the districts that you all cover, but I know in a district like New York City, probably like LA as well, a lot of our parents don't speak English with great fluency. What if the school had not just translation services, like we've tried to do with Make the Road by Walking so that all the materials are in, 25 different languages, but what if the schools, after school, at night, offered things like GED programs or English language immersion programs so that parents felt a real connection with the school, felt like the school was actually helping them? what would then happen in terms of being able to really engage parents when you needed to engage them about their daughters or their sons? So what we tried to put out on Monday was a vision that was much broader and bolder than saying that all of education policy should be based upon whether you agree or disagree with the testing and sanction law. Education policy in the United States of America should be bigger and bolder than that. It should be about what steps are we taking as Americans to ensure that all of God's children get to their potential. And that's what we tried, or that's what I've tried to say, or that's what I've tried to say this week. Now, there's a lot of things that AFT locals have done over the course of the last several years to accomplish that. But we can't do it alone, and we can't do reform. We will never agree to reform that's imposed on us as opposed to reform that's done with us. But when people actually talk to our leaders and our members and treat them as the professionals that they are, there are so many things that can get done. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. Here in New York City, we're running two charter schools. How many of you knew that? That the union actually, thank you, Elizabeth. How many of you, how many other than the people who cover me or the people who cover the UFT knew or know that we actually, the union actually operates two charter schools and is about to open a third one with Green Dot? Not that many. But I bet you all know the unions are opposed to charter schools, right? Yes, no? Everybody's so quiet. I'm trying to teach here. No? Did people not know that? I'm serious. How many people, you know, the whole canard is that we're reflexively opposed to all charter schools regardless of their any kind of existence? Thank you, Liz, for asking the right question. So the same is true in terms of differentiated pay. I don't call it pay for performance. I call it differentiated pay or differentials or things like that. How many people believe that the unions are opposed to anything other than across-the-board increases in pay? Nobody in this room believes that. Oh, good, I'm in a totally different audience than I expected to be. So here you have, in lots of different districts, you have things that the union has done. Take teacher quality. There are these great recruitment and retention programs about how to recruit and retain and create an induction process for teachers that are located in like the ABC school district in California that many of us have tried to emulate. There are lots and lots of programs on peer assistance and review, which is our way of directly combating the whole issue of ineffective teachers. Because the secret for most teachers is that teachers don't want to teach side by side with somebody who is incompetent or somebody who is just basically freeloading. If you talk to teachers, they will tell you this both publicly and privately. And many of us, but what they do want, and even, I don't know, how many of you have read the new Ed Sector report called Waiting to Be Won Over? Anybody? It's an interesting report that Ed Sector, anybody know what Ed Sector is? Ed Sector is a neutral kind of group that does a lot of research on a lot of different education areas. But they actually surveyed, they're not affiliated with anybody. They actually surveyed about 1,000 to 1,500 new teachers across the country. And they did a survey similar to a survey that they had done about 10 years beforehand, or 5 years beforehand. And this new survey showed that about 10 or 20% more teachers wanted to belong, new teachers wanted to belong to unions today than 5 or 10 years ago. There was a real uptick in it. And what they were saying was new teachers wanted fairness, and they really wanted due process. But what they also wanted was to make sure that the unions were doing more and more and more to both assure quality and to make sure that people had a chance to actually become qualified teachers. But what we've tried to do as in that vein have been things like peer assistance and review programs, which is where it wouldn't just be the boss that was saying whether somebody was floundering or not, but you would have your peers actually assist, and if they couldn't help, they would do things like counsel somebody out of the profession, or even, like we have in New York City, testify at a hearing that they tried to help and the help failed. So we have lots of locals who are doing this kind of work in terms of peer assistance. And then you have locals like my own and others that are doing career ladders, where you actually pay people who have shown that they are master teachers more than other teachers. And they're called, in New York City, it's called lead teachers, and other places it's called career ladders, because many of us really believe that you want to keep great teachers teaching, and you don't want the only promotional alternatives to be out of the classroom. Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense when you have somebody who's a great teacher and you say, okay, now leave. So there's a lot of these things that a lot of us are doing, but it's about working and having a respectful, collaborative relationship with the district, the superintendent, school boards, mayors, and really trying to figure out what works to lift all boats. So I can go on and on and on. I can tell you about all the other things we've tried to do. But at the end of the day, if you remember three things that I've said, number one, education, public education, because our obligation is to all children, cannot be reformed through great sound bites or through quick fixes. And every time, for those of you who have covered us for a long time, every quick fix has failed or is bound to fail. Number two, teachers really, 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 both their unions as well as themselves, want to make a difference in the lives of kids. I've made it clear in terms of this union what I said on Monday and what the response was. Number three, you got to help us do that. I know the press can't help us do that, but the way that we get help to do that is if we actually do it together, where reform is collaborative, it is done with us, not to us. Thank you very much.